Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 1st, 2003. Today's session is Border Crossing from Barriers to Bridges, Session 2 of Bridge Crossing, a Transforming Adventure, presented by Vicky Schmidt, SCV-2003-02. Let's listen in.
That's the clue you've all heard that one right now, I'm sure. My name is Vicky Schmidt, and I'm from West Fargo, North Dakota. I work with an organization called Sister Parish, where we make connections between communities of faith in North America and communities, marginalized communities of faith in Central America and Mexico, and along the Texas-Mexico border. Long-term accompaniment, solidarity kinds of relationships that really help us walk into the context and reality of another culture. In this particular workshop, I'm actually talking mostly about the Texas-Mexico border. And these pictures are from a recent delegation that I brought to the border from Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, a group of professors, to look at the issues of immigration on the Texas-Mexico border and some of the borders and boundaries that we find there, and then to take that a little deeper. These are not long-term relationships as I just spoke of. This is more an immersion kind of program to help people get some insight into what's happening in the border, and then perhaps make a longer-term commitment to relating to an actual community of faith there. And Margaret Sawyer is here today. Well, she's been here a while, but she's helping me with the forum because she has just come to Holden from El Paso, Texas, and worked in a lot of these situations that you'll see here, and part of the time she's going to share her experience there. And then Christiana Lindholm has worked with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services and worked on detention issues, youth detention, right?
Well,
or
everything.
All detention.
Yeah.
Okay, so she has knowledge of what borders and detention and detainees and undocumented people are about as well. So both of them, feel free to jump in if you think of something, and especially when we get to the Annunciation House where Margaret has spent time, she'll share some of that with us. And I'm going to stay back here and kind of share these slides from here so I can reach my computer clicker. Like I mentioned, I went to El Paso, which borders Juarez, Mexico. And to most people, this is the vantage point of the city. It looks like one big city, but in reality, there's actually a fence right running down the middle of the city that divides the city. It's a border. This is from the Mexico side in Juarez. And here, divided by this border, people make maybe $5 a day at their job and maybe have to spend $3 for a gallon of milk. A typical family on this side of the fence needs 3 full-time salaries just to feed their family. Now we're looking from the U.S. side. This is our typical vantage point into the poverty of Mexico. One of our presenters told us, Mexico isn't a sad culture, it's a sad system. What's happening on the border really is a microcosm of the world. People come across the border looking for a future for their children. When people come up through Central America and Mexico to work in the maquilas, the factories along the border, maquilas basically means assembly. And people come there, work maybe for 50 cents an hour to provide food and a future for their children. Do you know that a lot of products used in healthcare in this country were made by people like this woman, Adriana, in Mexico, where she works for 50 cents an hour? Much of what you and I have, we are able to have because we are taking advantage of cheap labor across the border. People on the U.S. side of the border reap the benefits of this in their daily lives and in the economy. Borders are symbols. We have to ask the question, why do some people deserve a better life? It must raise questions as we look at these issues of people of faith. What is it? Is it racism? Is it classism? How do I treat other people? And then I have to ask myself, and maybe you too, what are the borders within me? We need to go deeper when we look at issues of the border. It's not just a black and white kind of answer. It's very complex, and it's not a matter of who are the bad guys. We probably need to consider that there are good guys running bad systems. This is a picture of a surveillance camera along the border. You can see it at the top of the pool there. They cost $1 million each. And the Border Patrol agent that we worked with or that brought us to the border told us that they were really hoping they would be able to get 14 more cameras. That's 14 more $1 million. And I certainly had to ask the question, how would that $14 million help the people on that side of the border so they wouldn't be needing to come over and come into this country undocumented and become a target for all kinds of injustice. Our group was standing at the border wall when three different immigration trucks pulled up in this little circle by us and talked, and then one by one the Border Patrol agents came over us to talk to us about why we were there. What are you doing here? What do you need? What do you want? And then we assured them we were a group of church people. And that calmed them down a little bit. We told them we were interested in looking at border issues and that we were okay. People on the Mexico side of the border can't afford basic services. So they end up pirating like this. They hook up lines to the main power systems and run them to their house. And oftentimes, a wire in the ground could be broken or the insulation worn off, and children in the streets pick up the wires and they are electrocuted. Mm-hmm. People put together homes with whatever they can find. This particular home fence is made out of a box spring there and other scraps of wood and tin, and sometimes we've even seen junk cars that are used for walls or sleeping quarters. This family is building a house out of straw, which is a well-insulated house, obviously. It's kind of creative in a place where it's too expensive to buy other building materials.
Can I add something about Anapa? The part that we're looking at is a colonia. It's like a neighborhood that sprung up in the outer part of Juarez after NAFTA was passed, when the American factories started moving down to the across the border, and Juarez grew by about 1 million people in the last, maybe 2 million, some huge number, in the last 10 years. And these colonias have grown out of that. The houses that we were looking at, a lot of people who live in houses like that work in the American factories. They work there, they make the $5 a day. The American factories provide them with benefits like health insurance. Sometimes there are certain bonuses that you can get, not in the form of money, but in the form of like coupons for certain stores. And they also have transportation to and from work. But those are the houses that people live in when they work in the American factories. And also, what she said about the milk costing $3 a gallon is pretty accurate. It's groceries on the Juarez side cost roughly the same as groceries on the El Paso side. So people don't have money left over to buy houses or live in better circumstances.
The first picture, I'm on the U.S. side, and they're on the wrong side in the sense of what my rights are and what theirs are and what their privileges are and what mine are. But the picture on the upper right is a bulletproof, and the lower left are bulletproof shields that are along the border in certain places that immigration officials stand behind in case they're being shot at. And the lower right is a border of rocks. That is the border right there. And one side is the U.S. and the other side is Mexico. But the truth of it all is really that we are part of a system that benefits from other people's suffering. And so we have to ask the question again, what do we do about that? Also in Anapra, not in an opera, but in the town of Anapra. Do you know this woman, Margaret?
I don't know her.
She lives in Colonia Sparks, and she was part of founding this community outside of El Paso. She and her husband worked clearing land from 1959 to 1975. All those years, clearing land in this kind of barren piece of land. There were no city services there, so they carried water in 5-gallon containers to their house, and they had no electric and no phone and no gas and no roads. And after her husband retired, he was not well, so the money they made had to go to medicine for his care. So they still couldn't get services, couldn't afford it. And people started moving out to this community, the Upstarts. So this woman, Anastasia, started a project called Proyecto Bravo that tried to convince the county for years that they needed services. And she worked from that time until 1995. That's the first time they were able to get water in this community. This is her little house, and her husband has since died. But that little water marker, that spot is right outside her front door there on the walkway. You can see it.
That's on the El Paso side? She lives on the El Paso side?
Yeah, in Colonial Park. And you see the water tower in the background now. So this woman, really, that was her sole purpose, was to get water to these people. And one would like to think that in Texas that people would all have water, but it's not that way. She got what was called, on that last slide, the Oak of Justice Award, just in the last year, I think, for her many, many years of just trying to get water to those people. Another interesting spot we were at the Clinica in El Paso. This woman was telling her story. She told us that she lived in a little house it's a colonia called Agua Dulce, which means sweet water. She said, "For 7 years, I washed dishes and looked out my little window, and I saw nothing but desert." She was really lonely, and she felt she wanted to be working, but her husband told her, "The only way my woman's going to work is if it's with nuns." So she said, "One day I looked out my window, and something was being built, and it was a clinic, and it was being built by nuns." So she started working at the clinic eventually because her husband couldn't take back what he said. So they service about 4,000 patients a year in this little clinic. About 75% of the people do not have any kind of insurance. They ask them to pay $10 for their visit, but the people are very poor and most of them don't have the $10. And most of the people that they service are undocumented.
It's on the American side, is that Mexican?
Mm-hmm. El Paso, outside of El Paso. Now you know these people.
Yeah.
Raudel and Rocio. We spend an evening, a couple of us spend an evening with them. He is a recovering alcoholic, and he struggles to support his family. He went to school to become a chef, and his goal is to get a good job in a restaurant. So far, he hasn't been able to do that. But we asked him what he would say to us, and his words, "Don't judge us by the way we look, talk, listen, open up, the world will be better." I thought that was pretty neat. And this is on the Juarez side of the border. Estella was our leader and our translator, and we visited some of the houses here in Juarez when we heard the stories of a couple of women named Eden and Paula. Very small quarters, their typical wages, taxi driver, $80 a week, working 9 hours minimum a day. Factory workers get $60 a week for 9-hour days. Minimum wage is supposedly $45 a week. But these are the facts and figures that these people gave us. They may not be exactly right, but they're in the neighborhood of
low as $5 a day in a factory, but you can also earn a lot more than that.
So they told their stories about waking up at 4:30 every day and leaving the house by 5, and they get home about 7 p.m. at night. One of the problems are that many of the factories in Mexico are closing. And so it's harder and harder for people to find jobs. These are companies like Reebok, Motorola, Kimball Pianos, Nike. There's about They told us there were 300,000 people working in factories along the border, and there are about 350 factories that they estimated there were along the border. They all are producing nothing for Mexico.
Why are they closing, supposed to?
Well,
maybe China is
moving
out some other
labor elsewhere.
Yep, they're moving it to China, and I don't remember the other places, but they're closing down here because they can do it more cheaply in other places.
It's such a catch-22 because the maquilas are so, there's so much that comes from them that's so frustrating that the wages are so low, that people are paid so poorly. But then at the same time, a maquila job used to be kind of a guarantee. If you came to Juarez, you could get a job in a factory, and with that money, you at least could get by, you know. And now those factory jobs are closing, and people are coming more to the U.S. because they say there's just no work in Juarez anymore, which is totally a new line that happened completely since September 11th.
They were telling us that a job in the Ford plant in Detroit, that pays $19 an hour, pays an employee $5 a day, not an hour, $5 a day in Mexico for the same job. So that's why it's so much beneficial for U.S. companies to set up shop on the border.
And $19 is only the cash that the employee gets. There's also as a Ford employee. What?
Say it louder.
As a Ford employee in Michigan or wherever, you also get a lot more benefits.
Yeah.
That's what happens to the employee in the United States when this happens. So.
Exactly.
Gets
right.
Laid off.
It's
right.
True.
Right.
It's true. Nothing here is. It's a frustrating story on this side, I think.
Here's an interesting little piece, though, that I had never thought about. A typical factory worker in Mexico has to work 400 hours to buy a television set. In this country, a teacher would work 10 hours and would be able to buy that television set. If the worker in Mexico was paid a wage equal to a factory worker in the U.S., that would raise the cost of the TV sold in the U.S. so much that it would cost me $8,000 to buy a television that now costs me $250 to $300. So this might begin to answer the question of why we're trying to keep people out of this country. We demand the cheap labor on the Mexico side of the border. And it hit me because I have 3 TVs in my house. 3.
Of course, the one big theory reason we want to keep people out is that we have big unemployment in this country. We have 8 million people unemployed, and the actual is probably twice that much. But people have stopped looking for jobs. So what do you do with those people? How can American workers? You have to feel sorry for them, too.
Mm-hmm. It's a complex, that's what I started off by saying, it's complex, it's not just black and white.
This is just the side that I think, I mean, we have border awareness groups that would come down to our house too, and you'll see the pictures of those, and this is the side that I think doesn't get seen as often. I think it's important to think about it.
Well, both of these women that we interviewed, you know, we're feeling things are pretty tough for them by what we heard and what we saw, but they both exclaimed, I have a good life. I thank God for my life. For 1.5 years now, we have had lights and water. I have everything I need. Pretty amazing. This is Maria Isabel and Carmen. And these are people I met in Margaret's church. Maria Isabel has a lot of health problems. She's 14 years old, wonderfully cheerful. Carmen is not her mother, it's her aunt that has taken over the raising of Maria. And it's a very, very tough life. At the time I was there, she was on kidney dialysis, and Carmen had to get up every, I think she said 2 hours with Maria Isabel. So she was very worn out. But this girl was the most cheerful, enjoyable person. Very difficult. It was a very touching story. Now this is where Margaret takes over. This is where Margaret lived, and I want her to tell you more personally what this was like and what Annunciation House is about and about some of the things that happened there.
Yeah. Do you have more pictures yet to show or of Annunciation House? Okay. That's our dining room. And that's one of our guests. His name's Julio Cruz, and he came up. He's a good picture to have there because he's pretty typical. He's from Mexico City. He has 3 little girls and his wife, and was working in Mexico City and feeling like he just couldn't really get by. He came to the border looking for work. He's a really hard worker. He got a variety of different jobs. He knows some plumbing, he knows some electrician work. He's a really good cook, so he did a little bit of each of those and got a job in a restaurant for a little while, but then the bus, something like the restaurant closed down or it didn't work out. He went one night to go work for someone. We would let people go overnight to up to work, and the employer held him up at gunpoint and robbed him of $600. And Julio was too scared to tell the police because he didn't want to get arrested. There is a law that says that everyone has the right. I mean, it's fairly enforced in most parts of the country. Everyone has the right to call the police when something like that happens to you. Your safety is at risk, whether you're documented or not. But in El Paso, definitely the police and the INS do collaborate. And it's not every time, so it's not a guarantee that the Border Patrol would be called if he were to call the police, but that risk is there. He became a good friend of ours, and he also eventually just decided, you know, I can't even take it. It just got to be too hard for him, and back to Mexico City. He was also one of the witnesses of something pretty horrible that happened at our house. These are all views from our house. On February, I feel like I should tell what the house does first before I tell that story. a kid was killed near our house by the Border Patrol, but I'll come back to that in a minute. The house is called Annunciation House, and it's a shelter right on the border, about 10 blocks away. The border's just right that way. And we open our doors. The idea is to the poorest of the poor, sort of materially. It was started by some Catholics in their 20s, some youth directors who were trying to figure out how to more fully live the Gospels. And they moved into this kind of abandoned by the diocese building that the diocese had lent them, and weren't quite sure what they were going to be doing in this poor neighborhood. And people slowly started coming and saying, hey, you know, can I stay with you? And they decided to follow kind of a Catholic worker model and open their doors to the poor. And slowly they started realizing that the people who couldn't find a place to stay anywhere else were the people without documents. All the other shelters in El Paso accept people if you have documents, and if you don't, the street is pretty much the only option. So they started opening their doors to that. Since then, that was 25 years ago, 60,000 people have passed through our house. And during the 80s, it was a lot of people escaping the civil wars in Central America. And now it's people from Central America and from Mexico. I think a significant date too is when in 94 they started changing INS policy, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and started really enforcing the border much more than they had before. They called it the new hold the line policy. And before that, our house wouldn't accept Mexicans. We would tell them, just go stay in Juarez, cross back for your work every day. And people would say, okay, no problem, I'll go back to Juarez. And now that's like, I've had to tell a few families, you know, you really need to go back to Juarez. We don't have any space for you, we're totally full. And they just look at me like I'm crazy, because it costs $200 to pay a smuggler to cross you across the border right now because it's so difficult. So people come across. The typical reasons that people came were that they were looking for work. They were willing to work usually in construction jobs. $25 a day was pretty typical in the El Paso side. People could get jobs for $30 to $35 a day too. People knew that those wages were lower. Sometimes they tried to get to California or Colorado. A lot of people passed through our house going to jobs that they already had in those states, that they knew the employer was expecting them, and they were going back to a situation that they were already familiar with. Right now, the crackdown on our border is really much more. We've got a much higher concentration of Border Patrol and people working on enforcing the border. So the way that people typically travel into the country, and right now, just to throw it out, they say that there's 8 million undocumented people living in the U.S. Doing the most menial labor. Working as a chile picker in New Mexico, you earn $20 a day for backbreaking in the sun labor. It's work that Americans typically, I don't know very many people who would be willing to work for $20 a day. And that's considered a pretty good wage for a Mexican. So to travel to these jobs, people typically used to flying was considered the best way to get anywhere, but now obviously that's not, with our American identification, that's not a possibility. So people hop cargo trains mostly, because every bus now also gets stopped. Every road out of El Paso, you probably experienced this. If you go within 40 miles outside of the city, every car gets diverted through an INS checkpoint and everyone's papers get checked. Unless you're blonde, in which case they don't care. But so traveling, hopping cargo trains is one way that people get farther in. We had a 16-year-old girl at our house who lost her leg hopping a cargo train Christmas a year ago. Or people pay coyotes, people smugglers, and that's a pretty crazy way to travel because there's no laws. My friend Henry paid his $1,500 to this man, and the man just took off, and we never saw him again. But if you could, if it did work out, sometimes that was a faster way to travel to your job, where people are expecting you, or your family, or...
Yeah, but a lot of... You heard recently about the 19 people that were found dead in that... was a truck or boxcar?
It was a truck. It was a semi that had 100 people in it. And they found 18 people dead. The coyote situation is crazy. I mean, it's totally... The illegalness of it is just astonishing. People really seem to have no morals doing it. But sometimes we were glad when people went with coyotes because it was... We had one woman from Guatemala who, she and her husband had gotten political asylum about 5 years ago for their involvement in civil rights work in Guatemala, and they had to escape, flee the country during the wars. But their 12-year-old daughter didn't have papers, and they couldn't petition for her for some reason. I don't know what the reason was, but the woman went back to Guatemala, picked up her 12-year-old daughter. They were indigenous, too. They didn't speak. The daughter hardly spoke any Spanish, only the indigenous language that she was coming from. They came and stayed at our house, and they had to get to Florida, where the husband, who was documented, was waiting for them, and they paid a coyote and got there the next morning, and all of us were like, but... You know, mostly that kind of traveling is really risky. So our house is considered, we call it just a house of hospitality. We offer food, 3 meals a day, clothing, and basic social services. If someone comes in with a slashed hand, sometimes people would get pretty hurt crossing the border, we would be able to take them to the emergency room. But the only medical services people can get are pretty emergency medical services. So the basic social services that we could get for people. We were very careful to avoid any involvement with any coyotes, any involvement with the things that we couldn't do were illegally harbor, which we weren't doing. INS knew that we were there, and they know about our house. They would bring people to our house sometimes too. Often if they had a family that they were going to be deporting, they would keep the husband in the detention center and bring the wife and daughter, or wife and child, to us because they know that we'll accept them. We're the only shelter that would. So harboring is the first thing you can't do, illegally hold someone in secret. The other things were aid and abet. We couldn't actually physically help someone out of the county, help someone over the border. Those were all things that we just avoided. People would ask us too, you know, my 6-year-old is still in Mexico. Can you please help me get them across? Are you kidding? And then the other thing was conspiracy, which became tricky because conspiracy means if someone were to sit down with me and tell me, you know, my plan is to go to hire someone, a coyote, to go to this place, what do you think about that? You know, I could listen to the plan but not respond with anything and just, you know, good luck to you, like, you work it out. But it became a very fine line that we were walking. Although we've been doing it for 25 years, and INS knows about it, we had a huge anniversary celebration with 1,500 people from El Paso coming and celebrating with us the anniversary of Annunciation House. And also, our house is completely funded by private donations. People would come by 3 or 4 times a day with food for us, clothes for us. We had different places that donated fruits and vegetables and meat, and people sent in money, and it was all privately done. So the whole city really supported the house. I mean, obviously not the whole city, but a lot of people were involved in the house. On February 22nd, Juan Patricio was a 19-year-old who was staying at our house from the west coast of Mexico, and he was outside taking out the garbage for the house. And INS, for the first time that we know of in the last 15 years, pulled into our driveway and parked right in front of our house as if they were, you know, as if they were someone who lived there. And they have a general policy of leaving social service agencies alone, so that was a surprise to us. And when they came, Juan was outside, they stopped him, asked him for papers. As he was being physically searched, they found that there was no weapon on him. He was against the car, and one of the volunteers came out and asked him what was going on, and he took off running, which was really stupid. And everyone, you know, was watching. A lot of the older men were just saying, oh, you know, what is this kid doing? But he took off running. They followed him, they couldn't find him. He picked up a stick and was walking in the street with a stick and shouting at INS stuff about, I'm not the crazy ones, you're the crazy ones. You know, he really had told his friends, it's a thing about dignity. If I ever get caught again, I'm going to run. I'm not going to let them catch me like a dog. So, and he was kind of a hothead too, but he was walking along, and they say that as the last INS car pulled up, the other ones all were already, there were already seven people out with a gun pointed at him, and as the last one pulled up, he turned around. The INS agents saw him turn around, and the last ones that came up shot and killed him. That's the version of the story. There's lots of versions. That's the version that I heard from the witnesses from our house and from the other people who were living on the street alongside and saw it happen. There are people on a bus that saw it happen. It became a big issue of what's the truth here, obviously, because INS came on the TV a few hours later and said he was trying to beat an INS agent with the stick despite the 30 feet distance. I don't know. You know, so there's lots of possibilities, but it felt like a huge injustice, and it felt really like there was no life in danger on the part of the INS, and that there was no need to kill him. So we had a mass for him. The other really upsetting thing that happened with this was that 10 of our guests were witnesses to it and were taken to the police station for questioning. They offered to go. The police asked them, will you please come? We can do a more thorough investigation if you'll come with us and we can ask you questions. And the police contacted INS, who came and tried to deport the witnesses that day. They called us and said, can you please bring the children of Elvia Garcia to the border? Because we're going to deport the whole family now. And we said, can she talk to a lawyer? Just a minute. And a lawyer was able to keep them from being deported. But for their own case, for the case against the INS official, they were trying to deport our guests. So we did have a press conference about that. Had this mass that 400 people came to. It was totally beautiful. But Vicky was there the week that he was killed. And our guests set up these altars. We had about 50 people staying at the house at the time, and it just changed everybody.
So. I just remember the fear that was so much in the atmosphere, because some of the people we talked to said they were afraid to go outside. And yet they needed to earn money, and they had their little
There house. Were some guests, especially from Central America, who didn't leave the house for a few weeks, like at all. They didn't walk outside. They wouldn't take out the trash. They didn't feel safe being outside. And a lot of them said, I have this feeling, I just know. And you know, there's a thing about Latin American culture that's pretty superstitious. I just know that I'm next. They killed him. Mm-hmm. It's going to be me next. Why wouldn't it be? He didn't do anything. So,
how do you feel about working with on the fringes of the law, helping people who are breaking our laws? How do you feel about that? I mean, do you think it's morally right to do that? I mean, there is a legal immigration procedure. These people are trying to break it, trying to break in the law and get ahead of other people that are coming here illegally.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about them? Do you think it's right to help people break the law? And the same with employers. They hire people like this, they're breaking the law too, which is against the law. And we have unemployment in this country. You know, I have a hard time with all this. You know?
I know. No, I understand that. I understand that. My parents have a hard time with it, too.
Do you think it's morally right what you're doing?
I really do. I've thought about it a lot, and I really do. The employer situation, I feel, is more questionable, because I think a lot of employers take advantage of people coming with no rights. And I agree with you. I think that that's...
If we enforced our laws against hiring illegals, they wouldn't come.
But I think part of it is like what she said, we don't want to admit it, but we like having these people here doing all this work for low pay, because we reap the benefits of it.
We don't. Employers do.
No, we do.
Well, wait a second now. Look at what cheap labor does for this country. puts Americans out of work. We pay subsidies for housing, subsidized housing, for low-income people. We pay for free medical care. We get food stamps all the time. See, the employer gets the benefits from the cheap labor. We pay the taxes to support the cheap labor. It's a great deal for the employer. It's a great deal for the employer.
You're talking about kind of a huge situational change. I think you're right. I mean, I think in some ways we do support a system that keeps people in poverty, and
yes,
employers do gain that. I agree with you.
Yeah, the employers make the money, and we pay the bills.
The
it's a wonderful deal for the employer. That's the reason employers spend millions of dollars on both sides of the House in Congress to
I agree with you. I'm right there.
Black laws. And now
I
it's
agree
going,
with you.
Now
the
it's going.
Players.
Now it's going to the middle class, with the technical people with H-1B visas, which are being abused widely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Silicon Valley pays millions of dollars to Democrats and Republicans to get more H-1B visas.
Right, for sure. I agree with
you.
The thing about Mexico...
But so people break the law, and we just laugh at it. So we say, oh, we like cheap labor, cheap lettuce, cheap fruit, stuff like this. It's not that cheap, frankly, by the way. I mean, labor costs about 10% of the cost of agricultural products. So you could double the wages of the agriculture worker. Get Americans to do them. You say they won't do them. They will do them.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it myself when I was a kid. I worked in bean fields, picking beans.
You know what
beans.
It's like then, right?
It's hard work.
It's hard work?
Sure, but
yeah.
I did it, though.
Right.
I'm an American. See,
right.
I do it.
Right.
I wanted the money.
Right.
Well, if you pay Americans a reasonable wage, which more than you get on welfare, they'll work. But if you bring people in like this, and you keep help support people coming in like this, illegals, that's going to work for nothing compared to American standards, and you're going to just perpetuate this mess.
I think that you and I are standing on similar sides as far as, mm-hmm, I think both of us agree that it's a really screwed up system. It's a really screwed up system. I agree with you. The thing that I see about the border that made me feel okay, made me feel good about the work that I was doing was that there were a lot of different things. I felt like... The only way right now that a Mexican can get immigration permission to come to the U.S. is through a student visa, which are, you know, rare and only for people in university. Most of Mexico is fairly illiterate. Almost everybody I met misspelled most of Spanish that they could write. So with a student visa, or there's a law called VAWA, which Violence Against Women Act, if you're married to an American citizen who beats you, and you can apply for citizenship if you're married to an American citizen who's and you're in a violent relationship with them and they never try to fix your papers. Obviously, that's a really small percentage of people. Or you can be petitioned for by a family member living in the U.S. So there is no option in there for someone who's low income, trying to make a better life for themselves, trying to escape the poverty of Mexico, just trying to do that, you know, coming to the consulate and saying, I can't get by. I would like to be an American citizen. It's not an option for them. I agree with you.
So the American needless places can't get by now. That's tough. That's an American problem.
No, I agree.
It's just not fair.
I mean, I know.
The basic problem is that the world has too many people for too few jobs. That's the basic problem.
I think that we're living too nice a life. I think that those people need to be sharing our lives with
just
us.
Too many people.
We have a lot of resources in this country, and I think it can be shared, and that's what it came down to for me.
What's the end of this? How many people do we have to take in?
I think there shouldn't be borders, but that's another.
There shouldn't
you know,
be borders.
I think that the fact that we live on an island of our country, I think we're living a life that keeps our blinders on. I think we're not seeing what's going on around us.
You know, the best thing that could happen for the working people in the world is to have fewer of them. Then they could demand more money.
These are all good ideas that you have, I think.
I mean,
I
so
do.
that to me, the fundamental problem should be try and get fewer people born. Try to give women the option of birth control, like Guatemala you talked about yesterday. I just looked it up in my room there. 30% of the women are using birth control in Guatemala. That's one of the lowest rates in Central America. And they have the highest birth rate. Surprise, right?
I think you're just seeing, you're pointing out all the sides of the problem. There's tons.
But destroying the American economy by bringing in cheap labor, it's just going to make this country just like the other countries of the world. Is that what we want? Well, you know, maybe we should be poor.
That's kind of what I think. I mean,
yeah. It's a wonderful thought if you're not involved in it. But if you're an unemployed person, you're saying, wait a minute now. It just snowballs, you know. If we bring in India, Indian from India, computer technology people, And then we complain, but nobody wants to get into computer technology. Well, but you're paying $30,000 a year instead of $50,000 a year. Who wants to take it? They're going to become lawyers, financial planners, accountants, all these good jobs, which are worthless as far as growing
food. I finished what I wanted to say about the board, but I wonder if anybody else had any questions or if you had more that you wanted to say about it.
Well, I just want to say that in our area, where I live in the Red River Valley of the North Valley that separates or along the Minnesota-North Dakota border, and our farmers there depend on the Mexicans that come north from across the border. There are people that will not take those jobs in our area, and the farmers are searching for help, and they depend totally on the migrant farm workers. The people in our area are too good for what? Cheap, you know, they'll bring a family of 12, 13, 14, 15 extended family to our area, and every one of them works, and that's their income for the whole year. So what they earn in the Red River Valley, pulling weeds from sugar beets, which again is sunrise to sunset, backbreaking work, it's just enough for them to live through the next winter on before they come north again. And our economy depends on them.
Well, I question that. I have a challenge.
Well, I'm talking about my area.
People will work, you know, if you pay them enough.
I think that
people will do any kind of work if you pay them enough.
I'd like to just hear if there's anybody else that have any other questions.
Well, I can remember in World War II, a little bit, the hobos ran on the railroad and up in North Dakota. My grandfather would go down to the hobo place and get them to work, and they were whites or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd come for a day or two, and then they'd get them. But that was another type of cheap
way of finding day labor.
Right, and they just wanted a meal.
Mm-hmm.
And a little money.
We just have a few more minutes, but I wondered, Christiana, do you have anything to add about detention issues that you're familiar with?
I guess detention isn't so much a specifically border issue as it, I mean, it is a border issue in that it deals in a way with people who are coming in at ports of entry. So, like, not necessarily U.S.-Canada or U.S.-Mexico, but the border in the sense of, like, anywhere that there's someone entering the country. There's definitely going to be more, but detention centers exist in every state. So it's not just what you think about as land borders, I guess.
Margaret, has the immigration INS policy changed between administrations from Clinton to Bush?
It was under Clinton that they started to hold the line, keeping the border more tightly enforced.
September 11th really changed it.
Right, and then the next big change was September 11th. And since then, there's been a lot more money for Border Patrol. There's been a lot more agents hired.
Isn't it interesting it kind of goes full circle, because the administration is spending a lot more money on INS, and they're refusing to spend money on supporting world efforts at population and birth control, just like this man wants.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, it seems like if they would just spin it the other way,
if we could be helping. And the other thing is, we cooperate with the Mexican government. We treat the Mexican government, you know, okay, we're going to legitimately deal with the Mexican government. And there's a lot of things about the Mexican government that are really corrupt. People come to our country because the family that I want to talk about, I'm trying to figure out how to talk about Vespers tomorrow. It's an 8-year-old little girl with cancer of the eye socket. She was treated for 5 months in Mexico, but her family finally couldn't pay any more money. Everyone in their entire extended family was completely drained paying for the chemo. And the doctor just dropped it. She couldn't pay. The doctor dropped it. There's no safety nets at all in Mexico. Public education costs money. Everything costs money. There's no government-provided social services, essentially. And they came to the U.S., and she came in February, and we still haven't found a doctor for in the U.S. either, or in Mexico, with the consulate helping us. So I think that by us treating the Mexican government and tons of other governments like, oh, yeah, great, you know, thanks for doing business with us, I think that we're also creating our own problem, you know. I think I agree with you. It's a relief. There's lots of sides to it.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Yeah, we're from Southern California, so we see this whole thing in spades.
Right.
And then, like in San Diego County, the county hospital, 90% of the births are to illegals.
Mm-hmm.
So then their child becomes an American citizen automatically, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then the next day the welfare worker comes into the hospital room and says, oh, this is a new citizen. This is your the month. You better stay here and help take care of this new citizen for us. You know.
They don't do that in El Paso. I'd be surprised if they did that in San Diego. In El Paso.
I talked to the congressman from San Diego. 90% of the births in San Diego County Hospital are to illegals. And
right.
It's not just
I'm
to
just,
Mexicans, by the way.
There's no permission for the undocumented mother to be in the U.S., is what I'm saying. The INS doesn't offer them any special status because
well,
this
no.
is undocumented.
And I heard stories of people who were indeed separated from their children because of that. In fact, in Fargo, we just had a woman who was deported, three children. She was deported back to Mexico. The three children are in Moorhead, Minnesota. I don't know what to do. She's... Actually, it's happened several times. She's found her way back.
Well, see, what happens is that when the baby is born in this country, that baby can sponsor the mother as a immigrant.
When
legally.
They're
21.
Until,
when
they're 21. Yeah,
not until they're
21
years 18
old.
Anyway.
No, 21.
But this has been going on with rich people, too, from like Hong Kong.
Sure.
They brought their pregnant wives over, and that's first in this country. And, oh, now we got a U.S. citizen here. Korea, it's a big business from Korea. In LA, there's agencies set up. All they do, for $20,000, they'll fly you over here, spend a couple weeks here, have birth, go back, and now you got a legal citizen here in your family.
So one of the things we haven't talked about is the generally accepted statement that we're getting a lot of, most people coming over the border are criminals or bringing in drugs. And I asked an INS agent about that, and she said that in reality, about 97% of the people come across for economic reasons, and about 3% they document are actually criminal activity. And that was a startling fact to me because I've heard so much talk about all the people bringing drugs. And there are a lot of drugs that try to get over, well, people that try to get over with the drug. And she said about 1 in 10 of them are caught.
In the shelter that I lived in, when I first got there, I said, wait a minute, you know, we have this dormitory of 18 homeless men, and I'm just going to go walking up to my bedroom, and I'm going to lock my door, but that's the plan here. And everybody was like, what do you mean? I thought, what do you mean? And, you know, it was a beautiful thing. People came across with the desire genuinely to be working and to be there for good reasons and to really... You know, showing us pictures of their kids all the time. If you've got people engaged in conversation talking about how maybe their wife died and their kids are with their mother, and or their husband died or their husband left them, or, you know, family reasons and money reasons. American factories closing, no factories near them, living in Oaxaca where you can't farm anymore because lots of other reasons that involve American farm subsidies too, but and the NAFTA laws which make free trade okay. But, you know, lots of reasons for people coming. And there were problems. We definitely kicked people out for drinking. And we had a guy pull out a knife once. And, you know, for sure there are problems. But I met probably 1,500 people in the time that I was there. And I could name for you the number of people that we had genuine problems with.
Margaret, I'm sorry. The reasons for those people coming... it's reminding me of what the reasons my ancestors came here and all of our ancestors came, and I feel like we need to remember that that's why we're here too. And so what makes us have more of a right to be here necessarily than these folks? And it is a complicated issue, but
if we paid if we had to pay 4 to 6 to 10 times more for products that we buy from these multinationals, and if they were required to pay a more appropriate wages to the person who works on the Juarez side, would that keep people there? Is it just the money, or is there other attractions about some of these people who want to be in this country?
That's
that?
A good question. A lot of people said that would be enough. That if they could find work in Mexico, they would stay. They don't want to be. A lot of people told me, you know, your country has so many rules about everything, it makes me nervous. I don't want to be an American. I like being a Mexican. That's my flat out thinking about it. There were people on the other side too who said, I love that my kid goes to school here and I stay in school from 8 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon, and it's not just half a day and I don't have to pay for them to go to school here, and the teachers are really qualified and my kid comes home knowing how to spell stuff and knowing how to do math. I want to stay, you know. A lot of people had that perspective too. I think that there was a little bit of both. I think a lot of people felt like if they could make money, you know, I met plenty of people from southern Mexico who'd already tried to find work in Mexico City and couldn't find the work that they needed to find to support their family. They tried to go to maybe Chihuahua City and then to Juarez, and finally came across the border as kind of a last resort. There were a lot of people like that. At the same time, I agree. You know, I think a lot of people also think America, land of the free. Like, I want to be part of that too. One, this boy who was killed had met an American woman and was hoping to marry her, and he and she had established that there was not much of a love relationship between them. He said, "I want to be an American like you. You have so many rights. You can do so much with your life. There's so many opportunities for you. I want to be an American like you." He said that to me.
Well, we're committed to being out of the room at 6 o'clock, which I guess we need to honor. Appreciate all your insights and thoughts. I think one of the things that rings in my mind is the many years of working with refugees or people who are undocumented, that most often when asked why they came, their answer has to do with, it's because I want a better future for my children.
Absolutely.
And becoming aware of these struggles is a part of entering into the important discussions about our faith issues and how we do respond.
And learning how to walk with people, learning how to recognize the problem and start from there. Yeah. To see fully the whole situation. Yeah. I think there's a lot to say.
Well, thank you for coming. If you want a dialogue with, especially Margaret, once I knew she was in the village, I knew she had to be here personally to share this because it's more meaningful for me. So thank you so much.
I think you're doing a forum next year.
How about doing it this week?